From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Hello, this is MC Fontaine welcoming you to another Bletchley Park podcast extra. This week we bring you a little more from the Mythbusters event. Best-selling author Michael Smith was joined by the official GCHQ historian and also making a rare public appearance, former Bletchley Park Codebreaker and later GCHQ director, Sir Arthur Bonsall.
What I want to do now is just a quick run through for you. Enigma was first produced by a German called Chervius in 1921. It was a commercial machine. It was designed actually for companies and banks originally, but the German Navy took it up in 1926, German Army in 1928. Luftwaffe didn't take it up until 1935. The Polish mathematicians broke the system in 1933. They'd been in touch with the French intelligence, who had supplied them with a user handbook. And the great thing about this user handbook was that they had a message in German and then on leaf it, Enigma equivalent. And it had actually been done on an Enigma machine. So that gave the Poles a great way into the system. They also, of course, had their own commercial system, the Enigma machine, which they bought. And they also had, also provided by a French spy, settings for 2 days. That shouldn't mean that it takes away from what was then an incredible achievement. They broke it purely in a mathematical fashion. And when he heard about this, Denniston, the head of GCNCS, decided to start recruiting mathematicians like Turing, like Welshman, and eventually people like Bill Tilt as well, of course. Dilly Knox. This man doesn't get any way enough credit, and actually Kim Philby in My Silent War in 1968 revealed that Dilly Knox had broken the German Advent Enigma machine. He broke Enigma during the Spanish Civil War. He also made the first UK break into wartime Enigma. The way that happened, and the key issue here, was what Dilly, who was, dear old Dilly, was in fact eccentric, and we have Mavis Beatty's word for this. She worked alongside him, and she frequently remembers him picking bits of his sandwich off and stuffing it into his pipe, thinking it was his tobacco. He went to Poland with Denniston and with another man called Sandworth, who was a communications expert. And they went to speak to the Poles, and they'd spoken to the Poles in Paris previously, but that was really just about building confidence. And in July 1939, in the Piri Forest, he came at last to speak to the guys who were actually working on the systems. And he spoke to the Polish mathematicians and was tremendously impressed by these guys, having not been impressed by their bosses, who didn't really know what they were talking about when they were briefing Denniston. To his great joy, he found out what the Kwetsu was. The Kwetsu was the keys that look rather like a typewriter key are fitted into the machinery inside. And what Dilly didn't know, and he had got virtually to every point of the system, the one thing he didn't know, Turing didn't know, it wasn't just Dilly. Twin couldn't work out, Peter Twin, who was another mathematician working with him. None of them could work out how the connections were made between the keys and the actual wheels inside. And so which letter was attached from the key to which letter in the system? So was it, you know, A to P or T to X or whatever? Their assumption was that it must be random, because if you've got the opportunity to have so many different permutations, you're going to take it. And that's a very logical reason. And you can imagine that the mathematicians all thought this was right as well. It wasn't just Dilly. There was a woman called Mrs. B.B., and we don't know what her full name was. We don't really know her identity, and even how she came to make the suggestion. She suggested that it was A to A, B to B. I think you're probably there before me, but She was right. That's what the Poles told Dillon. And that was the key piece of information that allowed the British to break Enigma. So Dillon was almost there. It was just this silly little thing that he hadn't worked out. So he comes back to Britain. There is a problem with the information the Poles have given them. Someone at some point has written it down wrongly. Whether they were British or Poles is not clear. Turing goes to France, gets that information, and they make the first break into Abwehr Enigma. The British come to Bletchley Park on August the 15th, 1939, is the first reporting date for most of the early staff of Bletchley Park. The huts begin to go up very quickly because, as I said earlier, this was supposedly for MI6 and Government Code and Cipher School. It was very, very cramped, even when it was just Government Code and Cipher School, as it very quickly became. Mavis Beatty, Battle of Matapan in March 1941. The Royal Navy destroys the Italian fleet in the Mediterranean. It's a very interesting code-breaking thing that happened here. The one problem with Enigma, you will hear lots of stories about operators messing up. Operators always mess up. Whatever system you're using, you'll find operators messing up and foolishly going over the air, talking in plain text about what the problem is and how to sort it out. The main problem with Enigma, and it looked like a security addition initially, it must have looked like that, was Enigma machine could never, if you press the key for T, T would never come out. It was the one letter that would never come out. So if you pressed the key for L, the one letter that would never come out was L. And Mavis Beatty was looking at this message from an Italian Enigma machine, and it was a long stream of letters, and she realised there was no L in it. And it was actually a test message, and the operator had just been sat there, she always says, with a fag in his mouth. I don't think she quite knew that for sure. But what she did know for sure was that he was just typing out L, 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 practice message on those settings. And that's how they broke in to the Italian Enigma machine. And that's how they managed to get the orders and the timing for the Italian fleet attacking a convoy from Greece to Alexandria. And the Royal Navy intercepted them and destroyed them. Italian fleet doesn't come out of port again.
I think there are two separate things, again, going on with Matapan. There's this one message, which is absolutely crucial, in tipping off Admiral Cunningham in Alexandria. It effectively says, today is D-3. Doesn't take a mathematical genius at this point to work out when D-Day is going to be. So they know that there's going to be an Italian operation. Now, at that point, there's a whole set of other things happen. You know, they begin to send up reconnaissance aircraft to try and find out where the Italian fleet is. And I think there's yet another myth is somewhere around the idea that you look at SIGINT completely by itself. You don't. It's one of the contributing pieces of information that helps build up the big picture. It's an important one, but it's not the only one. The more complex story about the sort of the second message and was it sent by unorthodox means, again, the way in which this intelligence was disseminated was controlled with ferocity. It had to only go by certain channels, it could only be seen by certain people, it had to be paraphrased before transmission, it had to be re-enciphered. There was a paranoia about the Germans, obviously, finding out that this material was being read. We know of a couple of occasions that there are references to urgent information being sent by unorthodox channels. This is one example. Another example is talking about what information may or may not have been sent to General Freyberg in Crete. And I'm afraid the simple answer is we don't know. Because the material was sent on unorthodox channels, there's no records kept, so it may or may not be true. Montgomery was effectively a junkie for intelligence. He was a great believer in keeping it secret and arguably appreciated the need to keep totally secret, the need to protect Ultra at the end of the war because it put his performance in such better light. A perhaps different version of that is that, and this is a true story, is that One of the problems when trying to interpret signals intelligence is that it's fantastic, you learn exactly what Rommel is telling Hitler. It doesn't mean that what Rommel is telling Hitler is the truth. And so even though you've got the material from the horse's mouth, Rommel exaggerated the weakness of his logistic position, he exaggerated the strength of his insights into British intentions. And the other part of it, of course, another bit that rarely gets a mention, is the success of German cryptanalysis, particularly in the Africa Corps, against British tactical code systems. The Germans had a good insight at low tactical to operational level on a day-to-day basis what the British Army was trying to do. So again, the myth, if you like, suggests that SIGINT to the 8th Army was very black and white, that it was turned on, Montgomery got it, Montgomery swept Rommel out of North Africa, whereas the truth is a much more complex and multidimensional thing.
It's not just Rommel's messages, and it's certainly true that because we could intercept the red Enigma, which was a Luftwaffe Enigma, it was the only way that they could safely, or so they thought safely, transmit data from North Africa to Rome, and from Rome onwards it was sent by fish. But this was Rommel's plans for action with the British. That's how we found out about that. But one of the key things that helped Montgomery in North Africa had nothing to do with the German plans. It was to do with the convoys providing supplies. So just as the U-boats are taking out our convoys in the North Atlantic, the Italians are shipping lots and lots of supplies to Rommel. We break the Italian ciphers, which are producing the dates and the times of the routes of the Italian ships. We also break the light blue Enigma, which is another Luftwaffe Enigma, and it's the Enigma machine used by the Luftwaffe providing escorts for these ships, and that allows the British to take out those ships. And what the British had to do in order to prevent the Germans or the Italians realizing that their ciphers had been broken, they had to put aircraft up in the air. You just needed one aircraft to be spotted by the convoy, you know, so that a British aircraft has seen us, and that's the explanation for the attack that subsequently comes. And that put a stranglehold on supplies to Rommel and was a key part of his defeat.
Dieppe. Did the Germans know that the Allies were coming, and was the operation actually there to support the development of further SIGINT activities? As to the first, no, the Germans didn't know that the Allies were coming. They achieved complete tactical surprise. However, once the convoy that was going across the channel, as it was getting near to Dieppe, it ran into a German convoy, and so they lost the secrecy of what they were doing. The tactical communications that they used, the Germans could read, and the Germans had been practicing against Allied exercises on the south coast of England. They'd been easily able to collect this material, and they'd been able to decipher it. So once the Allies began to communicate, it was quite clear what was happening. The programme that came out probably a couple of months ago now about Dieppe, that suggests that the whole operation was developed around the need to do a pinch to capture information about German naval Enigma, is interesting. The historian Professor O'Keefe, who presented the programme, I think produced some very good evidence that trying to capture this information was part of the plan for Dieppe. I find it very, very hard to believe, however, that an operation of the size and scale of Dieppe would take place just for that single purpose. I think there were lots of other things going on around the time of Dieppe, and whilst that may have been a part, and a part that was previously unsuspected, I think it was only that, it was only a part. Another interesting thing that comes out of the Dieppe story is that Bletchley Park wasn't involved in it at all. That insofar as there's any evidence that a pinch operation was being organised, it was being organised exclusively from the Naval Intelligence Directorate, from Ian Fleming, but he didn't actually consult anybody in Bletchley Park. There's nothing at all in the records to suggest that they had any involvement.
D-Day invasion of Europe, what are the key ciphers? And the first one is actually that Japanese purple cipher, which we didn't break, the Americans broke. This is the Japanese diplomatic cipher. What happens is the Japanese ambassador goes to northern France and sees all the German defences. He takes his people with him. They produce a long, detailed list of all these defences, and it's sent back to Tokyo in the purple cipher, and people are breaking it, not just in America. We were breaking it here. We had the same machine to do it, supplied by the Americans. And they think, well, we've got, you know, the greatest picture of the defences you could possibly have. And the next thing that happens is the Japanese military attaché in Berlin goes down to northern France, and he goes through it with his military eye and reports everything and the weaknesses. And he reports this all back to Tokyo, and it's intercepted. And this is a cipher which actually was broken here, Japanese military attaché, broken by John Tilton. The next thing that happens is the Japanese naval attaché from Berlin goes down to northern France, and he looks at everything from a naval point of view. And so we've got this massive dossier provided by the Japanese inadvertently on the German defences. So that's critical. Obviously, numerous Enigma ciphers are important. Jellyfish and Bream, these are just the two lines between, Jellyfish is between France and Berlin, Bream between Rome and Berlin. And surprising as it might seem, a lot of the intelligence on what was going to happen and the German defences and German responses to what would happen in northern France was sent on the link between Berlin and Rome. But remember, these are very, very high level. You're getting Hitler's point of view. You're getting Rommel's point of view. You're getting point of view of the top people. And the other one that's rarely talked about, the Abwehr Enigma cipher. Basically, when the war broke out, the Germans obviously sent a lot of agents to Britain. MI5 and MI6 between them grab hold of large numbers of these agents. They turn them. They persuade them that they've got no future unless they send force messages back to the Germans. Now, that's fine, except we have no way of knowing whether the Germans believe us, believe these false messages. Because although we know what they're sending in their ciphers, what we don't know is when the agent handler gets that information, the message he sends to Berlin and the message Berlin sends to him. Most of the agent handlers were in Lisbon or Spain. The reason we can't read them is this Abwehr Enigma. It is a four-rotor enigma. The way the wheels rotate, you press a key, the first wheel rotates one time. And every time you press that key, it rotates one time. The simplest ones, the very early ones, that first wheel rotates a whole time and the second wheel rotates one time. And so it goes on, and that second wheel rotates a whole time. And then the third wheel rotates one time. With these four-wheel Abwehr Enigmas, the point at which the next wheel rotated was intermittent. It wasn't as clear-cut. Dilly Knox broke the Abwehr Enigma cipher December 1941 and died, sadly, in 1943. He was one of Britain's greatest codebreakers. He barely gets a mention, although he was the one that Philby singled out. And without knowing what the Germans were thinking, we could not have been certain that our deception plan for D-Day would work. So we had this deception plan. We had used all these agents. We built up this idea of the first US Army group, which was based in Kent and East Anglia, had loads and loads of tanks, all of them rubber or cardboard. Everything was made up. The Germans believed it. The Germans believed it existed. Their main agent we used in the double cross system, and there were a number of them, but the main one was a guy called Garbo, Spaniard. They believed, because Garbo was telling them, that the British attack would be in Calais, not Normandy. Even as the ships left for Normandy, Garbo was telling them, don't worry, this is just a feint. Keep all your stuff in Calais. That's where the main attack is going to be. The generals didn't buy it and had moved three armoured divisions down towards Normandy. Hitler did buy it and said, get them back up to Calais. And without that, it's quite possible that Allied forces might have have been thrown back into the sea. And I think the reason I'm saying that is because, making such a thing about it, is because I think, personally, that maybe one of the greatest things that was actually done at Bletchley, it certainly had a crucial effect on the war.
The story is that the air section at Bletchley began working on the radio telephony traffic of German fighters generally. And this became important when Britain went over to the offensive. I mean, the Germans were attacking, raids on the Midlands and so on were the main thing to worry about. But it became a matter within a year, and it really coincided with the Germans turning east. Their bomber force largely evaporated and went out east. And the main intelligence requirement of RAF Bomber Command was the effectiveness of the German night fighter force. Well, Bletchley had demonstrated that we could produce information about that from the radio telephony, but the Air Ministry refused to allow us to report it. For a year, they said it wasn't our job to report intelligence, even though here we were with intelligence that wasn't available from any other source. They said we shouldn't report it because it wasn't our job. Our job was to break codes, and that was it. This wasn't code breaking, this was producing intelligence. Well, in a year's time, the pressure got rather heavier because the Americans had joined the war, were totally dependent on British SIGINT. They had no SIGINT organisation of their own in this Western theatre. And they got in touch with us and discovered that this source of intelligence existed, and the Air Ministry gave in. The Air Section began reporting on Bomber Command's requirements for night fighter intelligence from then onwards, and was reporting also to the American 8th Air Force. And in a way, the American 8th Air Force, so they were getting from us the same intelligence, anything that we could produce about German night fighters, were a much better customer for it.
I think we're going to have to call it an end there, but can I just ask you, because this is something that you mentioned to me, I think, when we were actually talking about the Mythbusters, yeah, that the Air Section was in Hut 4, which is, of course, the restaurant, for those of you who don't know, yeah, over there. Because Naval Section was in Hut 4, they moved into Hut 4 as well. And it was always written down as Hut 4 being the Naval Section, yeah, but Air Section was crowded into there as well. Can you just give people a feel of the accommodation and what it was like in the hut?
Well, as far as I remember, Hut 4 was the same size as it is these days. And I think there was only one door, and it's in the middle. I guess it was exactly in the middle. You go in through this door, a narrow corridor. All corridors were narrow. You walked into the corridor. You turn left through a door into the naval section and right into a door into the air section. I never went into the naval section. Admittedly, we moved from there after about a year. We moved into Hut 10, which was a great improvement. Inside, at each end, they were probably much the same, but I don't know what the naval one was like. It was a lot of little rooms. We didn't have the idea of great big expanses with no partitions. It was lots of little rooms, each housing four or five, perhaps, with crowded trestle tables, folding chairs, private cushions maybe, no radiators. Here and there in the hut, there would be coke stove or a paraffin heater. And the windows, to begin with, were glass. But because of the threat of bombing, the glass, certainly in Hut 4, was replaced with a sort of plastic transparent stuff in a wire mesh. And the local blue tits learned that that was eatable. So the windows, in fact, largely ceased to function as keeping us warm. Cold was one of the things we were very conscious of during the winter months.
Thank you very much, guys. Ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks for listening, and we'll have another Bletchley Park podcast extra next week. But in the meantime, Why not follow our channel on Audioboo, where you can also subscribe to the RSS feed, or subscribe to us on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter, where we're at BPart Podcast, or join the Bletchley Park Podcast Facebook group. Once again, we must thank all the speakers involved in these recordings, and of course, Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. Thank you.